"It's not safe to be me" is a distortion. It's not the reality. It is safe to be me. And as Oscar Wilde once said, "Be yourself. Everybody else is already taken."
Hey there, and welcome to Work is Third. I'm your host, Dawn Hunter, and I'm so glad you're here. What would it take for you to truly be who you're meant to be? Today, I'm joined by Jonathan Cabe, author of The Tree and the Mountain, Dare to Become. Jonathan was a partner in a prestigious Geneva law firm, outwardly successful, yet inwardly drained, restless, and unable to enjoy the life that he had worked so hard to create. Determined to bridge that gap, Jonathan turned inward, asking himself who he truly was, what mattered most, and why he was chasing so hard. We get into the story behind the book, along with some important insights on why work-life balance might be the wrong goal entirely. Let's listen in. Hello, Jonathan, and welcome to Work is Third.
Hi, Dawn. Great to be here.
I'm really glad to have you here and looking forward to talking about your new book, The Tree and the Mountain. And to kick us off, I would love it if you could share a word to describe how you're doing today.
I'm feeling energized.
Ooh, where is that coming from? What are you feeling energized about?
About this conversation, about the day I've had, and the beautiful rest I will have later on.
Oh, that sounds like the best part. The rest after it. I'm looking forward to some rest myself. I just got back from traveling and looking forward to just kind of having a quiet evening after we're done recording here today.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah. So we first connected, and one of the things I'm most interested in talking to you about is because you are also an attorney who made a major life shift, as I have done as well. And that actually led to the writing of your book. And so I would love to start there. Tell us a little bit about your book, and then let's talk about the journey that led to it.
Yeah. So The Tree and the Mountain is a fable. It's a modern fable which invites the reader to dare to become who they're meant to be. And this is the culmination of a 10-year exploration of myself, and going from attorney to creator of a company and leadership coach.
Okay. And I know that I read the comparisons, and one of the books that came up to me, The Alchemist, was one, but also I read a book, and I don't know if it's an appropriate comparison, but The History of Rasselas, which I think is also a similar fable of a journey of kind of self-exploration.
Yeah.
What made you decide to take that approach of the fable, aside from the fact that we know storytelling is how people really learn? But was there something else that motivated that approach?
Yeah, two things. One is I dreamt about this story. I had no intention of writing a book. I had a recurring dream of this tree, of this mountain, of the journey of a protagonist, me or other people, up the mountain. And because it just kept on coming back, I thought, I have to write this down. There's no rational explanation of this. And a fable, because I'm inspired by fables. I speak in metaphors. I think our rational mind lets its guard down, and we know we're reading a story, so it reminds us of our youth and of plunging in and those emotions of Disney films and things like that. And so I thought, hey, the dream is coming. I love fables and stories. Let's go and see what happens.
So I'm curious about this kind of what you made me think of as intuition. And I'm curious if you've had things like this before where you've had dreams about or an intuition about a thing that you should do. Mm. Or is this something that was new that you experienced and you wanted to follow it and explore it?
Yeah. I had an intuition when I was 18 years old. I took a gap year and went to Pakistan, of all places. I had no connection to Pakistan, but it was between school and university. And I went to Pakistan to teach English as a volunteer teacher in the north of Pakistan. And I was teaching English to a very poor community. And that was their way to be able to join the government or business. And so I was bringing something valuable. And I had the greatest year of my life. And I knew that this is what I should carry on doing, sort of teaching, transmitting, sharing experiences. But I came back to New Zealand, which is where I'm from, sat down at the breakfast table with my mother, who said, "So what are you going to study at university?" And I had a moment where I said, "I don't know." And she kind of whispered, "How about law?" And because I had nothing better, I said, "Okay." And so 7 years of university and law later, and then a career, 15 years as a career as a partner, I kind of came back to my intuition, which was transmitting, sharing, teaching. So I should have listened when I was 18 years old, Dawn. I should have listened.
Okay, that's an important lesson, because one of the things I've also been exploring is this concept of doing the things that you think you should do, or following the path that you think you should. And then once you're set on a path, kind of sticking with it. Yeah. I went to law school as a second career, but I worked in health policy. And then I arrived at a point a couple of years ago where I was like, is this actually what I want to be doing? You know, or am I doing it because that's the next logical step? Yeah. And should I be listening to logic, or should I be listening, you know, to my heart?
I realized later on, and thank you for sharing that. I realized later on that because I didn't have clarity and conviction at 18 years old, I settled for something else. Okay. And law, you can want to be a lawyer, or it's a very good foundation for a lot of other things, right? Way of thinking. But I realized afterwards, I did my 7 years of law at university, and then more, because law brings structure. It brings a kind of authority. And I grew up without a present dad. He was on the other side of the world. My parents divorced when I was 12. So I didn't have that father figure growing up. And so later on, I understood, when I look back on my life choices, I completely see how law filled the void of a present dad and that authority figure.
Can we talk about that a little more? I'm really curious, because I also think a lot about, I grew up with a lot of structure. And then when I went to university, it was a different world, because I didn't have an externally imposed structure. It was a lot more free, right? And so that really shaped my university experience, and then also maybe my career, because then I sought out jobs that had more structure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are there other ways before you got into law that you sought to give yourself that structure, or was it something that you even thought about?
I remember, well, again, with retrospect, I sought structure by being a terrible adolescent to my mother. I have apologized since, but I was horrible. I was, you know, I was doing everything you weren't supposed to do, probably as I was looking for structure. And just going against her, so, you know, drinking, smoking, all those things that you shouldn't be doing. And I think with retrospect, there was no reason for me to want to do these things apart from looking for boundaries in my life to be able to sort of set myself on a track.
That's really interesting, because I used to work in residential foster care. And one of the things that we talked about frequently is that children crave structure. And so when they're acting out and they're pushing against it, it's in some ways because they want an adult or a caregiver to impose structure on them.
Yeah.
And they're not entirely conscious of that, but it's something that is an important part of our development, is that we need somebody to say, here's the container that you operate in.
100%. And the learnings that I've applied to myself, I now apply to my children. Explaining to them that my role as a parent is to put boundaries so that they can learn to identify them, and that this will help them grow into fulfilled and meaningful and joyful people. So when I say no to something, I will always explain why I'm saying no, that, and give examples of why it's a no and what it might cause here, and why we need to stay within the boundary. And initially, you know, they're angry, you know, you don't know anything, etc. But then later on, I see my son and my daughter sort of having digested it, having thought about it. They do come up and give me a spontaneous hug that I don't ask for, but I think they realize after the emotion comes down that I was there not to say no to them or to hurt them, but to help them. And the hug is the proof of that.
Well, boundaries is one of my favorite words. And it is so important that we teach people that, you know, the importance of saying no or hearing no sometimes. And that ultimately, even when we hear no, sometimes that's for the best, right?
Completely. A no to something or someone is a yes to something else. And we respect people who respect themselves. So setting boundaries and saying no, and you know, people can sense the energy behind a no. You know, there's like a power play no, you know, which is unhealthy. But when there's a no and it's clear and it's not against the person per se, but it's for something else. So I could say no to this invitation to go for a drink with a colleague or a friend because I'm saying yes to my family or yes to my gym time or yes to my sleep because I'm tired. So if the person doesn't accept the no, it's more their problem than your own. And they might actually have a difficulty saying no themselves, which is playing out in their response to our no.
Well, I love the way that you phrased it in terms of the way that you say no. I read an article this morning that was accompanied by an infographic, and it showed here are, you know, seven other kind ways to say no, kind and clear ways to say no. And my initial reaction to that was actually no is clear and kind. It's kind to yourself. It's kind to other people if you say it in the right way, right? And so I struggled a little bit with that idea of, no, I think no itself is a powerful word, sentence. These other ways to say it are also helpful, but I never want people to think that saying no is something that you have to adjust for other people's comfort.
Yeah.
Just say it.
Yeah, just say it. You know, I'll share with you, when someone says no to someone else, it's a question of their filter. Now, what I mean by filter is that some of us have a strong filter, kind of protective filter around us. So you could say something to me and you could give me constructive feedback, or you could say no to me to a request that I make. Now, if I have the filter, your no or your constructive feedback, I know that it is about a behavior or a performance, or you're saying no, not to me rejecting me, but saying yes to something else. Okay. So this Dawn says no to Jonathan. Absolutely fine. I respect that. I'm not interpreting it that, you know, Dawn doesn't like me or, you know, Dawn likes someone else better. People without a filter will go, it's as if it's a rejection of themselves. So when they hear a no, it's like, no, you can't exist, or no, you're not important, because their fears are coming to the surface and interpreting Dawn's no, which if we asked Dawn would be completely crazy. She's just saying no because she has to do something else, not because she doesn't like Jonathan or like someone else. So we've got to be very wary of when you get a no, for instance, when you get a boundary from someone else, that it doesn't trigger our deep fears that kind of come up and then start whispering in our ear, I'm not good enough, I'm not worthy enough, otherwise Dawn would have said yes.
So then the question I have for you in follow-up is, how did you develop your own filter? Have you always been really strong with your boundaries, or is this something that you developed over time and learned through different experiences?
Yeah, so great question. I developed it over time, because 10 years ago, I was a partner in a prestigious law firm here in Geneva, Switzerland, looking after some of the wealthiest entrepreneurs in the world. So on the outside, everything was wonderful, and, you know, family and a house in the suburbs and, you know, voila, nice trips away. But I was very empty and depleted and role-playing on the inside. I didn't know who Jonathan was anymore. So there was this dual world of great on the outside and people going, I wish I had your life. But on the inside, I was completely miserable. One of the reasons for that, I realized of the last 10 years of exploration, which finally led to the book, was I didn't have a filter. So any rejection or any criticism or any even constructive feedback, I was taking it and my inner child was getting whacked, basically. and keeping my confidence low. And so I was working harder and doing more, you know, more to try and ensure I would never get a no, that I would never get criticism, because I had no filter. 10 years later, I've developed the filter so that if I'm receiving feedback or a no, or even a personal attack, I have a protective filter that says, no, my worth belongs to me. I decide my intrinsic value, not the outside world. I will listen to what you have to say out of respect, but I don't have to accept it. And so this protective filter helps me stay aligned and closer to what I call inner peace, because I don't let the outside world come in and dictate my view of myself.
As we all should, but it's such a challenge to develop that filter. And I'm curious too, so you built your filter over this 10-year period. Yep. Was there a triggering event or moment that you also said, you know, now that I've got this filter and I'm able to kind of take in what's going on in my world, I need to make a change? What did that look like for you?
So the change from law to something else happened 10 years ago. And it's in the last 10 years that I've developed that filter.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. But there was a trigger event. I was offered the senior partnership of the law firm, which is the holy grail, right? For a lawyer, you get to the top of, and I knew that if I accepted that, I would keep on sort of having external success, but at the cost of my person. I don't know whether it would have led to divorce or to bad relationship with my kids or burnout and health problems. I don't know, but I felt, my intuition was telling me that's where you're heading. So I quit, Dawn, I quit. I said no to your kind offer, but not only that, I'm resigning. And they said, you're absolutely crazy. What are you going to do? And I said, I have no idea. I have no idea. I have no plan B. Two young kids. And because I knew that until I figured out what was happening on in the inside, the dynamics, the patterns that had brought me to this position of outside success but internal loss, I would probably repeat it. So the last 10 years have been understanding that, building the filter as part of my explorations, so that now, because I've got a strong filter, I'm able to help other people create their filter and take back the power over themselves.
I really appreciate you clarifying the timeline for me. And I'm curious of what kind of conceptions you had about what it meant to be a lawyer, what it meant to be on the path that you were on, and what kind of maybe external pressures that you were dealing with. And I say pressure is more like, what are other external expectations that might have been weighing on you that you had to consider when you said no to the kind offer, as you said, but you ultimately were saying yes to yourself? What were those other pressures?
Part of a lawyer's role, as you know, is timesheets, so billable hours. And so, you know, you're paid for your time. The more time you're billing, the more you get. So there's a kind of, especially in lawyers, I think there's this unhealthy thing of the more you work, the more you will get paid because of that system in most parts of the world. But the pressure wasn't actually coming from outside. If I'm honest, yes, there were big files, there were big clients, they had a lot of problems, but I was fine dealing with them and they didn't keep me up at night. It was the pressure I was putting on myself from within to be perfect, to not disappoint, to be visible, to prove every day that I deserve my place in the partnership, to make sure my clients would say, this is the best legal advice and service I've ever got. So this was internal pressure, because no one on the outside was asking me for this level. They wanted a very good level, but I was going for the XXL level. And I realized later that came from my deepest fears within myself, which I'm happy to share with you. And there's four: fear of not being loved, fear of disappointing people, fear of abandonment, which comes from the divorce and my parents, and the fear of not being seen. So when you understand your fears, in the deep part of the iceberg, that explains so many of the patterns and behaviors and excesses on the surface. And I'll finish with this. That had led me to become completely mind-driven, whereas now I am heart-driven. Very big shift.
I'm curious about your experience today of being heart-driven. You know, you've had a career. You had certain expectations and appearances. What is that perception kind of in your world of people seeing that shift in you, right? From being no longer a mind-driven, but now being heart-driven. What's that looked like?
Well, it's I've come back to my authentic self, because the mind is developed from a very young age at school and then maybe university, and then it's developed in workplaces. And that's all external. And that's great, and it's necessary, and we have to have sharp minds, and it's the greatest supercomputer that exists, and it's in our head, so great. But the heart-driven is one which is focused on balance. The mind was focused on performance. Now I reach high performance not through being mind-driven, but ironically by being heart-driven. And the heart, because it's focused on balance, will make sure you have time for work, because the heart knows that work is a fundamental part of life, and you need to work in the system we live in to earn money and then do things. So it's not saying don't work. It's not saying don't perform. It's just actually putting these boundaries we were talking about before. The boundaries come in so that at 6:30 in the evening, when you promised your partner to go on a date, or you promised your son to play football or baseball or whatever, the heart will say stop, and you put your pen down and you go out without any guilt. The mind could override that commitment and say, but you haven't finished your file, Dawn. You haven't finished your file, Jonathan. And that creates the imbalance.
It's so funny. I had posted something recently on TikTok about quitting work on time, right? And at the end of every day. And somebody was like, but the deadline is Friday. And I was like, well, newsflash, deadlines are arbitrary. I mean, mostly, unless you are working in the law, in which case they're not completely arbitrary. But ultimately, everything is something that we can negotiate and balance.
Yes.
And I'm really curious to hear your perspective on this idea of balance, because I've seen a lot on socials lately of people saying there's no such thing, especially women, but perhaps this is a male thing too, where there's no such thing as work-life balance. Nothing is in balance. How do you think of balance when there are people who say there's no such thing as balance?
So I have a very clear view on this, actually, because I hear work-life balance. It's an expression that we've heard for years, and we say probably without even thinking about it. The problem I have with work-life balance is I think it's faulty in its description to begin with. And let me explain. We're basically saying work-life balance. So we're putting them in opposition, work and life. So the more I work, well, the less life I will have, whatever that means to us, personal time, family time, sport, etc. And the more life I have, therefore, then the less work I'm doing. Okay, so when they're put in opposition, work-life balance, you're actually guilty wherever you are, because the more you do here, you're paying the price of something else. Okay, and to stay at the sweet spot of work-life balance, oh, I'm in a flow, you might be there 2 seconds during the 24-hour day. So why is it faulty? Is that I see balance up here as the umbrella. And then we have 1/3 work, approximately, 1/3 non-work, call it whatever we want, and 1/3 sleep, if we break down the 24 hours into 8, 8, 8. So when we say, oh, I've got to get a good work-life balance, it's impossible. And we're sending ourselves on a collision course between two things which are not in opposition, but which are actually balance is here and work is 1/3 of balance. So when I say that, people go, I've never thought of that before, but I feel you're right. I feel you're right. I've been chasing something which does not exist. That's a breakthrough for me to go, no, I need to chase balance, balance between different things, not work-life balance. And I say, hey, well, this two-minute conversation has enabled you to jump up a step in your evolution if you're telling me it's a breakthrough. Wonderful. Carry on.
I like that description. I just gave a talk where I said the same stat, which is we spend a third of our lives at work. Shouldn't we enjoy it? And it's not separate. In some ways, I think it's very much integrated into there is just life. Work is one part of it. And then there are all the other things that you do. And so we're not really just balancing work and non-work, as you said. It's we're balancing all the things that we do along with sleep, right? And that's the other important piece, that rest piece that people also struggle with.
Yeah.
And I would like to ask you really what your perceptions of work are or what you were raised with. Yep. One of the themes on this podcast is the way that we're conditioned in childhood to have a certain approach to work, to want to be perfect, to want to perform, to want to achieve, and that there's a point at which some of us arrive, I know I have, it sounds like you have, where we say, that's not what is driving me anymore, but not everybody gets there. What were some things in your childhood that you feel like shaped your understanding of what it means to work?
Beautiful. Before answering that, in terms of work and that one third, work for me is an opportunity for you to be you in a professional environment. That's all it is. It's an opportunity for you to be you in a professional environment. The non-work is an opportunity for you to be you in an environment of your choosing. At home and with family, etc. And sleep is sleep. So my attitude to work is you have this opportunity, whatever your job title is called, the more you amplify yourself with your natural talents and your work ethic, etc., the job will take care of itself. So see it, you're being paid to be you, and that's directed towards the mission of the company, etc. So that's the first thing I wanted to share. The second is in terms of the messages I got when I was young was that work meant sacrifice. It meant that you had to work hard and then work harder to achieve things. And I think we get this conditionality when we're young, observing our parents or our reference people, grandparents, maybe some brothers, sisters, and repeating what they are doing. And my parents were both very successful, but at the cost of spending time with their children in some instances. And my mum will say that, and my dad, who was on the other side of the world, well, he would say that as well. So I repeated the same thing when I was working, despite the fact I said I would never want my children to have the same thing. My parents loved me. They've been great parents. But, you know, it's sort of, and I was repeating exactly the same thing. And even for them, I thought, I've got to break out of this pattern, because if I do this, then they will do it to their children.
It's important to emphasize that we all do that, and especially that modeling piece where what we see is also the behavior that we take on, unless there's something to interrupt that pattern, whether it's us or some external force that makes that happen. So I do appreciate you sharing that. And I'm curious if this is where the four fears tie back into the conversation. And I think I missed one, but it was like fear of not being loved, fear of abandonment, fear of not being seen, and
fear of disappointing. Yeah. And do you know what's underneath those, Dawn? Sorry to interrupt. I've realized that underneath those four fears is the distortion that it's not safe to be me.
I love that you said that, because honestly, the way that you described work, Jonathan, when you said that it's an opportunity for us to be who we are in a professional setting, that ties perfectly with this concept of the underlying fear is we don't feel it's safe to be us in that setting.
Correct.
Ooh,
that's exactly
really
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to truly, that's why we've got to kind of go deep to understand what's actually playing out on the surface and our behaviors at work, non-work, etc. the boundaries that we're putting, not putting, the no that we're saying or not saying. All of that on the surface in our daily life is wonderful to understand, but it needs to be connected to what's happening in that deep part, which comes from our construction, from our influences, from our values, from our cultures. But that inner system that created Dawn, that inner system that created Jonathan, once you start exploring the undiscovered continent, I call it, you know, the, going deep inside, you get so many answers which explain everything on the surface. So when I was walking in the Swiss Alps and the "it's not safe to be me" came up, I thought, wow, that's really at the core of my entire existence. And just verbalizing it, connecting to it, has completely shifted my relationship to myself and to that safety. But I hadn't gone that deep yet. So, well, I'm happy to share with you.
Well, I appreciate that. And now that you've arrived at that feeling of safety, what is it that makes you feel safe to be Jonathan?
What makes me safe is that I realize that this "it's not safe to be me" is a distortion. It's not the reality. It is safe to be me. In fact, I came here as me, and you came as you. And as Oscar Wilde once said, "Be yourself. Everybody else is already taken." You know, so I can't be Dawn. Dawn can't be Jonathan. Makes no sense. So, in my explorations, my purpose in life, my primary purpose, is to be me, and to explore what that means. Right. My secondary purposes are to be me in a work context, with my friends, with my family, in my sporting activities, in my travels. But it's always a discovery of self in these different environments, different interactions. And that has simplified my life in a massive way. So whether something objectively good or not good happens on the outside, I'm as excited going, this is going to help me discover who I am. So I take away the power of good or not good, good weather, bad weather. The weather doesn't affect me anymore. It's the weather that's there. And it's going to help me to be me. So you kind of take back your power. It's an inside out approach rather than an outside in approach that we were taught young. Because when we went to school, you never had an exam on Dawn, did you? I never had an exam on Jonathan. It was on maths. It was on science. It was on history. Always teaching us to look outside of ourselves. And the big breakthrough in the last 10 years is I've learned to look inside myself for the answers which I used to look outside for. And they're all inside.
I agree. I think that was part of my journey as well, is understanding that the thing that I was seeking, I already had, whatever that was, whether that was love or approval or anything really. And it's understanding that it all lives within you and that you have to just feel safe. You have to, your mindset has to be that I am safe to feel and be those things that make me who I am. And that's the journey that we're all on.
I think that's it. We're all wanting to be our authentic selves, and whatever role or responsibility or title or status or income, ultimately we want to know who we are and then apply it in the environment. So we're all chasing the same thing. And that's quite reassuring to know. Even though probably most people are not super conscious of that and don't get up every morning going, I want to discover who I am. They kind of get up and go, right, what's on my calendar today that I have to do? So it's a good reminder.
I am a very action-oriented person. And so I'm thinking of the fable and I'm thinking, we're on our metaphorical mountain. We've arrived at some realizations. Now what? How do we put this into action?
Well, a lot of different ways. I give you an example. I give you an example, maybe something very practical. So I have next to my desk a very old paper now because it's had so much food and coffee and things. But this is my success list or my greatest achievements list. Okay. And so I put on this paper everything I'm really proud of. And I've got things like a wonderful wife and two great kids, a company that reflects me and my values, spending a year in Pakistan, having the courage to be me every day. So this is not my law degree or my, partnership, very personal things. And I created this list and I leave it next to my computer. And I don't have my bottle here because it's in the dishwasher, but I have a bottle sitting on this list, which has water in it. And during the day, I fill up my glass and I've got tea here, but I drink water. When I see the list, I am conscious and I am drinking all of my successes, all of my achievements that I'm most proud of. Okay. And that is going down to the inner child, the little Jonathan, who's still 7 years old, who has all of these fears and these distortions that I mentioned. And it's giving him confidence that he has his place in this world and he's allowed to be here. And more than that, he's allowed to thrive and help the world become a better place. Okay. So when I see the list, I'm drinking my success according to what that means to me. When I'm coaching or advising or doing something and I pour without looking at the list, my subconscious is still getting the same message. So a very practical thing for people who lack inner confidence. A lot of us look very confident on the outside, but probably 90% of the people I'm privileged to coach and top leaders around the world, entrepreneurs, sports people, 90% lack inner confidence or have the imposter syndrome. 90%. And I was asking myself, but why all these people look so confident and successful, but they're all telling me they lack inner confidence until I realized that was the core driver of their success. Because these people get up every morning and say, I have to start again. I have to prove my worth. And so these are people you don't need to motivate and push out the door. Rather, you have to hold them back because they're like a stallion galloping, in the thing. And so what that does is that generates performance day after day because they've got an internal engine linked to inner confidence. Yeah. And so this exercise actually helps you close the gap between the external confidence and the inner confidence, which is preventing a lot of them from enjoying their success. And they share that with me. So I say, okay, you're going to create your success list. You're going to buy yourself a nice bottle and you're going to drink water all day long to start bridging the gap between your outside confidence and your inner confidence so that you find alignment and coherence.
What is perhaps funny about this or coincidental is that this, as I've told you, right, this is unscripted. I'm not asking you set questions or anything like that. But one of the things I wrote down on my list here before we started was to make sure to ask you how you define success, because that comes up quite frequently. And I appreciate hearing you describe it as being driven by your lack of confidence. I was that person. And that's really important to realize, because when you stop chasing that external validation, your life is so much more simple and more meaningful. And I want to, for listeners, draw attention to a couple of other guests, because we had a guest, Rene Rivas, who talked about, I have my glass of water, right? He talked about speaking your intentions over your water and drinking them in, which I thought was a beautiful concept. Mm-hmm. And then we had another guest, her name was Paula Thomas, who talked about creating your own win list. And one of the things I've shared is that I worked with my therapist and I struggled with, okay, how do I overcome this perfectionism? And she said, make a list of everything you're proud of that has nothing to do with accomplishment.
Mm.
And that was such a valuable exercise. And this is why I love that you shared your list, because you had things on there like that you have a relationship with your wife and a good relationship with your children and that you got to spend time in Pakistan. And it helped me to realize that all of the things that make me who I am and that bring me joy have nothing to do with the degrees I've earned or the awards I've gotten or anything like that, right? It's all these other, it's connection.
Yeah.
It's relationships with other people, but also with myself. It's experiences. And so it's such a great example. And I'm so glad that you shared that.
My pleasure. And it completely connects to your two other guests, right? The win list and the sort of and the intention of drinking water with an idea behind it. This kind of seems to combine both of them. So thank you to those two. Maybe there's two things to build on in what you said. One is one of the big realizations. We talked about recognition there. You mentioned recognition, and I used to look for recognition. It used to be my fuel. And if someone said, "Oh, that was great. You did a great job." That would justify the 12-hour workday I just had. It would, "Oh, wow. Someone's recognized me." And I would chase external recognition, working harder and harder to get it until the switch happened. And, you know, with what we've been talking about, mind-led to heart-led, et cetera, and learned to give myself recognition, learned to recognize myself. So instead of going outside for it, I learned to give it to myself. And the irony of that is that I get so much more recognition from the outside by ignoring the outside and by ignoring chasing the recognition. I don't chase recognition. And it yet comes in droves. So the system is very interesting. In fact, when you know, we chase things so hard. We chase love so hard. We chase recognition so hard. We chase trust so hard. And I say to people, you want love from the outside. You will get it when you learn to truly love yourself. And then you will appear like a magnet. You want recognition on the outside and it's not working. Learn to give it to yourself, to recognize yourself. You will get it in droves. You don't know what to do with it. Same with trust. Same with leadership. Learn to, you know, people want to learn to lead others. And I say, learn to lead yourself. Focus on that. And you will naturally lead others and help them lead themselves. What we're chasing on the outside, we have it on the inside. We weren't taught at school to look on the inside, but it's never too late. Never too late.
It's never too late. You remind me, I saw this prompt one time that said, what is advice you would give your younger self, but in three words? And you remind me, my advice would be love yourself first.
I love that.
Everything else flows from that.
Completely.
So speaking of loving yourself first, one of the things I like to do is ask all guests the same four questions that are somewhat related to that concept. And I would like to ask them of you.
With great pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, the first question is, because boundaries are an important part of my motivation for even doing this show, what is something that it is easy for you to say yes to?
It's easy for me to say yes to a meaningful conversation. I'll always make time for that. And it's very intuitive.
That's the best part. So then what is something kind of somewhat opposite, but could be the same thing? What is something that is hard to say no to?
An extra serving at dinner. It goes from something very deep to something very, I have a relationship to food where as if it's going to run out. And so if I'm offered a dessert, which I know I'm not hungry anymore or shouldn't have, I will crack.
You know, Jonathan, we could probably have an entire other conversation about food and our relationship to it. But I think I enjoy food. I love flavors and texture and like experimenting and trying new cuisines. And I have a hard time. If I love something, I'm like, I just want to eat the whole thing. I don't have to eat the whole thing. I may even be full, but I'm like, it tastes so good. What if I never have this again?
Yeah. Do you know what's helping me with that, Dawn? Is that I and this is quite recent. So ask me in 6 months, but the food we ingest, the food we eat, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner, et cetera, is an act of love for our body. And because food is, you know, has a physiological, we have a need. So I now look at food going, is this helping my body function? Is this helping my energy? Is this helping what I need for my body to be firing on all cylinders, like I want my mind to fire on all cylinders and my heart and my intuition? And so now I say, am I helping or hindering myself with this coffee or with this extra dessert or with this thing. And it just reminds me that I'm either helping myself or hindering myself. It's too early to give you the conclusion on that, but I've tried a lot of things to no success, and this one feels like it might have legs.
I'm going to put this on my calendar so I remember to, I'm going to email you and just say, hey, how is this going, where you're checking in with the food, you know, being intentional and mindful about your food choice. Yeah. I'm going to ask.
Yeah.
But it does seem like a good approach.
Right.
Okay, so the last two questions are related. And the first is, when it comes to the ways that you take care of yourself and support yourself to be the best, feed yourself, your intuition, your body, your mind, what is something that you do really well?
I check in with myself all the time. So I'm constantly asking myself, how do you feel, Jonathan? How do you really feel? Right? Not, yeah, good, not good. You know, I feel energized. I feel a bit lonely. I feel sad. I'm constantly checking in with my emotions and then going outside going, okay, well, if I'm feeling sad or lonely, including with 100 people around me, potentially, why is that? Where's that coming from? Most of it is internal. It has nothing to, but you're still checking in with the outside. So I check in a lot, and that helps me to tweak and calibrate when I feel I'm on a negative cycle downwards, so that I can change that cycle quite quickly.
There are several guests for whom that is also their superpower, really? Is checking in with themselves. Yeah, that's been an answer before. And I think that means it's an important tip for listeners to think, just be intentional about checking in with yourself, right? Yeah. That's something we can all practice.
Yes, we get into automatic mode. And when you're in manual checking in, you're driving the car. Otherwise the car is driving you. Big difference.
Right. So that's something you do really well, but where do you still struggle if there's something that you struggle with?
I struggle with my weight. I think it comes back to the food. I can go plus 8 kilos. Sorry, I don't know what that is in pounds, but plus 8 kilos, minus 8 kilos very easily. That's a lot. So that's where I still struggle. So I'm still exploring that with what I shared, but there's always things to work on. But instead of me being angry or frustrated with that, I've learned to embrace my weaknesses. I've learned to embrace what I don't like about myself, which used to frustrate and suck away energy. So first of all is the mindset and the awareness, and then it's finding the habit that's going to, you know, make it work. So it's become a challenge rather than a worry or a disappointment. And there's a very big difference in energy towards a challenge versus a recurring disappointment. So, you know, it reminds me that I'm walking up my steps of my evolution, and I still need to walk down the steps of self-discovery. And that's what the book, the Tree in the Mountain, is all about. It's all these discoveries, but instead of telling people, I've shared it through this fable, through this story, where hopefully everybody will be able to identify themselves to the protagonist. And through an exciting story, they're actually going into their different systems, how they make decisions, their fears, their energy system, their resilience system, and come out going, I read a story, but I feel like I've kind of discovered myself a little bit.
Well, stories are how we discover ourselves, right? So kudos to you for crafting this story and putting it into the world and sharing your experience, because that is what helps us to connect to other human beings and to learn on our own journey. Yeah. I've really enjoyed having this conversation with you, and I think you summed up your book really well. But is there anything else that you would want to leave listeners with?
Let your heart lead, your mind execute, and your energy speak for you.
Great words to end on. Jonathan, thank you so much for this really amazing, joyful, and powerful conversation.
Thank you. It's been an absolute privilege, and thank you so much for inviting me on the show.
Jonathan, thank you so much for this conversation. And listeners, remember that the fear underneath every fear is that it's not safe to be me, and that's a distortion, not the truth. If you want to go deeper with Jonathan, his book, The Tree in the Mountain, Dare to Become, is out now, and the link is in the show notes. And if this episode hit you the way it hit me, share it with someone who needs permission to chase who they truly are. Please like, rate, and leave a review. And remember, work is third. Put yourself first.